This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast as we catch up on our best bits, maybe your chance to listen to something that you might have missed. And we were having a special look at children on a recent show. Stress and anxiety in kids. It is an evergreen issue, but perhaps fair to say that the course of the last year has been, well, far from smooth, leading to physical symptoms as well as mental health problems. Dr. Rose Logan joining us, clinical psychologist at Genesis Clinic, talking about how we can help identify root causes and ultimately help our children deal with anxiety. And for teens, a big cause of anxiety has been that what next question. It was Audrey Hemetner from the Bedrock program who was on hand to help give the questions we need to be asking our teens and in the right way so they can understand what their path in life is. And one of my favorite topics, Lego. And yes, I have the broken manicure to prove it. I love Lego, but aside from it being deeply enjoyable, what role can bricks and building play in our relationship with our children? Why is play so important? And as we are a year into the pandemic, looking back at education and perhaps the long-term impact of COVID-19 on the future of education, it was David Cook of the Repton Family Schools who was giving his insights on what we can expect. Could exams become obsolete? And what about tuition fees? Fingers crossed they're going down. Let's find out.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, as adults, we are unfortunately all too familiar with stress and the many ways it can affect our lives, mentally, physically. But you might not be so aware that children can experience stress as well. And I sincerely wish that childhood was free from stress and was completely carefree. But the fact is, children can experience anxiety from all sorts of different things, disruptions in routine, changes in home and family, school, homework, bullying, friends, social situations, and of course, chucking a pandemic. Well, we are here to help this afternoon. And I say we, I definitely don't mean me. It's Dr. Rose Logan joining us, clinical psychologist at Genesis Clinic here in Dubai. Dr. Rose, how are you today?
Very well, Helen. How are you?
I am great. It's so lovely to have you with us. We're on Microsoft Teams, so I can see you, which is lovely. It's great to see your face. And I'm so, so glad to have you with us because I feel like there's a lot of questions and anxiety amongst parents, and inevitably this is being passed on to our kids. And you know, your clinical psychologist has been doing this a long time, working with children and families and couples and individuals. But I wondered if you'd noticed any, you know, patterns or trends in terms of the last year when you look back to pre-pandemic, anything different coming into clinic?
Helen, I think that we've always seen anxiety in young people, in children. And I think what you did a really good job at the beginning of kind of highlighting just the breadth of factors that can contribute to that. I do think that the pandemic has brought a sense of anxiety that's new for all of us. And so, yes, we've definitely seen young people coming into the clinic with more anxiety, more panic attacks, I would say, is something that I've definitely noticed in some of my older children and kind of teen clients. Just that sense of not being safe, of uncertainty that's just been so highlighted for everyone, I think.
Dr. Rose, can you explain what a panic attack might look like in a young person? I know in adults, you know, we see that kind of cliched image of breathing into a paper bag and, you know, feeling overwhelmed like the world is on top of us. But in our kids, how can we recognise it in them and how can we help them in the moment?
Yeah, good question, I think, Helen. And that very stereotypical image that we have probably from movies and things, we actually don't encourage people to use brown paper bags or any sort of paper bag, to be honest. And partly, if you think about it, there's not many paper bags kicking around these days. And so if you're dependent on something that's not available, that's a problem. And second of all, there's a kind of a pairing or an association that happens that when you suggest that you use something to help with the panic attack. So we actually don't really encourage people to do that. Obviously, if you've got somebody with you who thinks that's going to help them and you've got access to it, we don't stop them from using it. In essence, the panic attack is going to look very similar no matter the age of the individual, but I think it's the difference between the stereotypical image that we have and what that can actually look like in reality. So for a lot of children, it might be a paralysis type effect where there isn't an awful lot to see. Or it might be just a very, very heightened emotional state where they cannot kind of get their tears to stop. They're not able to manage their breathing. They seem very uncomfortable that they're holding on to something that gives them comfort, whether that's a parent or a transitional object or item. I do think it does tend to be more in slightly older children, tweens and teens, that we see this, less so in younger children.
Okay.
So it might look quite similar, but it can look very different in all of us, even in adults. It can look like nothing's happening rather than that more stereotype picture. So it's a bit complicated to give you one straight answer on that, actually.
But we do, you know, in adults as well as children, see physical manifestations of stress and anxiety.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the physical side in children, I mean, again, a huge range. I mean, I remember not wanting to go to school and saying I had a tummy ache, and then next thing I knew, I actually did have a tummy ache. Or, you know, we've heard about bedwetting, you know, coming back in children who have been potty trained and, you know, not wearing nappies at night for a really long time as a result of stress or an incident or you know, circumstances. Loss of appetite. What are some of the physical symptoms that we need to be aware of as parents?
Yeah, lots of physical symptoms appear for children, often more so than the thought-based symptoms that an adult might describe. And so there's the more obvious ones like sweating, shaking, shortness of breath, increased heart rate. Then there's the more emotional ones, so maybe being very tearful. And then you've got more kind of subtle ones, like you said, more somatic, like I've got a tummy ache, I've got a headache, I feel tingly, or I feel a numbness. That's something that a lot of people will describe, both with anxiety, but also related to panic attacks, that they get a kind of tingly sensation in their hands or their arms or their face. And often, like you said, it can actually translate into a physical experience of something that feels very, very visceral. Things like dizziness, losing, like kind of focusing, it's difficult for them, that they can't concentrate, they feel restless. Those are other types of more physical symptoms that children might describe. They might just tell you they're scared. Mm-hmm. They might just say, I feel scared, without knowing really what's going on or what's making them feel scared.
And it is a scary time for kids, you know, when we think about the pandemic and how to talk to them about it. A question from Cassie for you, Dr. Rose, saying, my 5.5-year-old is very quick to cry and tantrum right now. A total overreaction to the tiniest thing. Is this a phase? And then a question mark and about 3 exclamation marks, which I take to be a sign of desperation from Cassie. And Cassie is as a mother of a child who is much very, very similar. Everything, lots of big feelings in the small body, let's just say. I definitely sympathise. Is this a phase? And what can Cassie and myself do to try and calm things down a bit?
Yeah, well, listen, I'm going to add myself to the list. I also have a 5-year-old with some pretty big feelings around at the moment. And I think on the one hand, you know, I don't want to over-pathologize these types of behaviors, because at the age of 5, there is a lot of big emotion around there, and there's been a lot of big changes. And like you've so rightly pointed out, this year has been the strangest of years, and so many things have added to the stresses, the adaptation and adjustment that our children have had to go through. So I don't want to over-pathologize, and I do want to kind of keep that contextual element very, very much in the picture. But I also recognize that sometimes these experiences are really overwhelming for parents and children. And if it's really affecting both of you to the extent that it's, you know, it's an added stressor every day and through the day, then I do think it's something that we should be looking at. And all behaviour is, in essence, a communication, right? It's our child or ourselves even giving some sort of communication, some sort of information that all is not well. And so I do think that if it's something that's very persistent, something that doesn't seem to be resolving and it's getting in the way of other things happening in the day, then I would definitely encourage Cassie to seek a bit more of an in-depth consultation. If it feels like, look, there's a lot of context mm-hmm. and we're managing the tantrums really well and helping her to or him to navigate through those, and we're able to go through the day and go about our usual business, then I think it's a bit of a watch and see as life starts to pick up its pace again. We've had to adjust to kind of lockdown and quarantine and things, but we're now having to adjust back the way to, right. you know, other things that we used to do, but now are strange for us.
And Joe's been in touch, we were discussing earlier about kind of physical symptoms of anxiety and stress, and perhaps this is linked. Joe's asking about chewing hair. Our daughter is 7 and has just started chewing her hair over the last few months, tried tying it back, keeping her hands busy, and it's driving me crazy. Is this a habit? Can it be linked to anxiety? And what can Joe and family do about it?
Yep, I think it certainly can be an indication of stress, of some anxiety. Children kind of play with hair, sometimes even pull hair, but certainly chewing hair might be another indication that they're a little bit distracted, a little bit anxious, a little bit stressed. I think that Joe's done all the things I would have suggested that she do to help out in terms of, you know, tying the hair back, put it in a bun, or keep it really out of the way. What I might add to that, though, is to give her daughter something to keep her hands busy, because it sounds like she's looking for something to play with, to do. So one of the really popular things at the moment are those kind of bubble blister things that you can yes. pop and push.
Because it was fidget spinners a couple of years ago. And as you say, this I've seen different shapes and different colours, but, you know, let's say kind of 20 centimetres by 20 centimetres. And it's a bit like bubble wrap, but made from rubber. So you can push them down and they can be pushed back through again.
And I turn it over, don't you? And keep going.
Well, I was going to ask you that, you know, I mean, and they're, you know, 20, 30 dirhams. Can this be like a crutch that they can then become somewhat addicted to, or how do you feel about props and things like this?
Listen, I think it's a little bit like certainly with adults, we have whenever I do my work with adults, so it doesn't matter whether it's adults or children, if we're trying to change a habit, we have to kind of give ourselves the right support, the right tools, the right alternatives to help us navigate that change in habit. And so do we come dependent on those props or those tools? You know, obviously we don't want this little girl to feel like she can't go through life without her little blister pack. But I think that in the transition, using it when she's feeling distracted, or using it when she's feeling uncomfortable, or when she wants to chew her hair, and then you encourage her to put it down when she doesn't need it. Mm-hmm. And so we don't kind of just switch one thing for another. We're using this for a very specific purpose while we need it, and then we put it down and we carry on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how I would encourage them to use it.
Thank you, Dr. Rose. Dr. Rose, no name on this one. And we have had a number of questions about younger kids, so kind of under 10. But this question's asking about a teen saying, my 15-year-old son gets really nervous or scared before he sleeps and then finds it hard to sleep. What should we do?
Oh, that's a good question. And I think that for teenagers, especially, they are often carrying so much through their day. You know, they're carrying all of the weight of the studies and exams and projects and homework. They're carrying all of the social stressors. They're carrying all of those kind of changes in their relationships, their hormones, their physical transitions. And so I think it can be a very stressful period for young people as they kind of go through that 15, 16, 17 year old age. There's a lot going on personality wise, friendships are sometimes shifting. I think one of the things I often encourage young people to do if they're having trouble with sleep is to do a bit of externalizing before they try to go to sleep. Because often I think what we try and do is we try and switch off and go to sleep. And we're not a computer. We can't turn the button off. We've got to do a bit of a wind down. And all parents will remember what it's like when you've got a baby. You go through a really careful routine of, you know, bathing and massaging and singing and swaddling. And actually, we all need some elements of that as we get older, just changes the routine.
I love so a I swaddle. I love a good swaddle. But so kind of sleep cues then, things that can be put in place. So
yeah.
Things like, you know, whether that is, you know, writing things down or turning off devices or reading.
Exactly.
So an updated sleep routine for a teen.
Exactly. We sometimes call it sleep hygiene. Mm-hmm. And so a little bit of making sure screens are off a kind of an hour or so before you want to sleep, not watching something really high octane on Netflix, not drinking coffee, making sure the room is dark, having a shower. And also, like you said, writing stuff down, that kind of externalizing, downloading all of those lists of things that you've got to do or all of those worries. It doesn't mean they go away, but it means you kind of take them out of your mind so that you can rest a bit better. So externalizing, sleep hygiene, a good nighttime routine, staying away from caffeine and things like that. It sounds obvious, but actually, when you stop and look at your own routine, quite often we're not as good at it as we might think we would be.
Mm-hmm. A great question from Yasser here, Dr. Rose, saying, are some children simply more anxious than others? And I think that is a really good point because, you know, we see this in adults. I'm an anxious person. I'm neurotic. And, you know, people kind of define themselves by personality traits and, you know, how they navigate the world. But surely this begins somewhere. Perhaps some children simply are more anxious or highly strung or emotional than others.
I think certainly temperament has a role to play in anxiety. And often what we see is that is in combination with some family or kind of environmental factors. And so sometimes you get a really anxious child with very, very laid back parents. And so you know that there's a bigger impact coming from temperament. Sometimes you get a child who's a bit anxious and you realize that the family's also got quite a lot of anxiety going on as well. So definitely that's that whole nature nurture debate comes up here, doesn't it? And how much do we weight each side? I think in general now, though, we accept that there's an element of both of these that is present in any sort of presentation. So yes, definitely some temperament can be involved, but unlikely to be completely on its own.
Okay, interesting. Good question, Yasser. Thank you for that. Coming to the text line, Leigh says, my seven-year-old seems spaced out. He hums constantly, always on the go, can't sit still, can't concentrate. Do kids grow out of this? I think we're coming to lots of messages today, which are basically asking, is this a phase, Dr. Rose?
Is this a phase?
So this seven-year-old humming constantly, always on the go, can't focus. Could this be flags to something else or, again, purely temperament? I know it's very hard for you to say from just one message, but what kind of direction would you give to Leigh and her family here?
I would probably go a bit similar to what I said to one of the other questions earlier, and thinking about how much it's impacting function. And so at the age of seven, it's still, you're kind of on that kind of transition from, we expect younger children to be quite easily distracted, not to have really long periods of focus. Around seven, eight, we do start to ask children to be a bit more focused, kind of leave some of those more distracting habits behind. But he's still definitely in that developmental stage. So I don't want to be kind of in any way alarmist. But so I would say, first of all, think about how does it affect his functioning? If it's stopping him from engaging with school, if it's stopping him from enjoying things at home, if he's kind of really separated from the family because he can't engage in conversations, then I would go and consult with somebody. if it's something that kind of feels like, well, he's always been a bit like this, and he's still, if he puts his mind to it, he can really concentrate, I would be less concerned.
Okay, hope that helps. Like, Dr. Rose is with us this afternoon, clinical psychologist at Genesis Clinic. A question from Ali saying, kicking siblings, fighting all the time, is this normal? My 5-year-old daughter is always attacking her younger sister. Ali, again, nodding along in recognition, because we've had discussions in the last couple of months about this, and it seems to be lashing out. But I think at this age of kind of 5, 6, they don't know how strong they are, especially against younger ones. And it gives me, yeah, it really worries me, I think. So I'm with you. So kicking and fighting, Dr. Rose, what advice would you give to Ali, indeed all parents of children of this age?
Yep, I'm going to add myself to this list as well, if that's okay. I'm constantly saying, can you stop hitting your brother? Can you keep your hands to yourself? Can you? It's exhausting.
I'm going, kind hands, kind hands. No one listens to you.
And no one listens to
you. Never.
I know. It's so difficult, and it feels exhausting as a parent to constantly be kind of refereeing your children. I do think it's quite normal. Again, functionality is important. If you really feel like one child is kind of significantly hurting the other one, then we've got to look at it a bit more closely. But I think in general, it's a fairly normal phenomenon. As a parent, I think, as with most behavioural issues, we're looking at very firm, very consistent boundaries around what happens if you continue to do this and if you continue to ignore the parent's request to stop. And then also just some very practical things, like not having them sit opposite each other at the kitchen table, have one on one side, so diagonally, and then they can't kick them each other in the legs. And so being kind of practical where you can about minimizing the kind of potential for these things to happen. And I think also just talking to them about what it feels like to see them arguing, if they're old enough to understand, but you're kind of appealing to their better nature, which may or may not help in the spur of the moment when their sibling has taken their favourite Lego toy or whatever it might be.
It could be anything. And mine have got a real thing, like right now, about fighting about who sits next to me all the time, which sounds really sweet. And like, you know, like I should be flattered that my kids are fighting over me. It's not. It's actually really, really stressful. Dr. Rose, thank you for your time today and some good level-headed advice that I think we can all relate to. And I think it's always great to hear people's questions and messages, because it makes us realise that many of us are going through the same trials and tribulations and sleepless nights, whether our children are babies or indeed teenagers. And thank you so much. As I said, you are at Genesis Clinic, so people can get in touch with you there if there's anything they haven't been able to get to today, or people want a one-on-one consultation, you know, the privacy of clinic or online as well. Have a wonderful week ahead, and we'll talk to you very, very soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Helen.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking at teens this hour, and I'm really curious to get your steer on this, guys. Is your teenager feeling confused about what they want to do in life? Or maybe they've gotten to a great university but don't necessarily want to study there. Has the pandemic ruined all their academic plans, and how are their motivation levels? We're talking career coaching for teens this afternoon with Audrey Hemetner. She is the CEO of the Bedrock program. She helps teenagers and young adults determine what they want to do in life with workshops and one-to-one career coaching sessions. Now, this topic was suggested to us by a number of Dubai Eye listeners, and we love getting your take. We love connecting you with experts. So, confused teenagers, are there lots of them out there at the moment? Audrey, thank you for being with us. You're nodding along. I can see on Microsoft Teams. Lots of confused teens.
Yes, yes, indeed. It's a tough time.
Now, I think being a teenager is a tough time at any time. You literally couldn't pay me enough to go back 20 years and do it. But when we think about the impact of the last year in particular, where do you think that's kind of exacerbated concerns and worries?
I think it's actually affected them on all rounds, right? So if you look at one of the major issues that teenagers deal with, they deal with identity, they deal with social pressures, future lifestyles, family, further education, and COVID has hit all of them, right? So you know, when you look at identity, they're usually taking cues from society and from their friends and looking at, you know, a beautiful outlook on life and having expectations of achieving anything. And now they're looking at their life and they're all constantly hearing bad news, people dying, people getting sick, people being hurt, people around them. And they're really struggling right now with where do I fit in with the equation? How can I be a part of a solution? And very much a lot of them are pivoting in terms of what they thought was important to them before versus what's important now.
That's interesting.
And yeah. And with family, it's the same thing. You know, teenagers, I mean, I remember myself as a teen, I coach a lot of teens. The world is rosy in their eyes, or it's difficult and they have a chance to fix it. But never have this generation and even my generation had to deal with this type of wanting to fix a problem in the world so close to home, mm-hmm. That it's hitting many families.
And in a time of massive uncertainty, you know, you might have gone into high school thinking, I'm going to be, well, let's use a pilot as example. You know, I'm going to work towards being a pilot. I'm going to be, you know, putting all my, you know, energy and attention onto maths and science. I'm going to study this at university. I'm going to come out and I'm going to work in industry, which is, oh, and then next thing you know, and this has been the case for so many teens who perhaps are lucky enough to know what they want to do and be working towards a goal, only for those goalposts to be sometimes shifted and completely just, you know, just completely knocked down in some cases. So what I think what you do so well at the Bedrock program is getting an understanding of who these young people are and their values, you know, what is important to them, and basically finding their why. Can you explain a little bit about why that is crucial?
Sure. When we're young, we dream about what we would like to do, and we follow what we see or what we're told is a good career choice. And we sort of do it blindly, hoping that it's going to mean that money and fame or money and knowledge and our parents will be proud, right? Because we're young and that's what we want to do. We want to please everyone. But when you're a teenager and when you become more of yourself and you identify with who you are and you start to ask those difficult questions, it becomes more important to understand why am I following this path? What is it that I want for myself and for my contribution in the world? And that sort of nugget of gold in the center of the decision making is what keeps the motivation, not just throughout university, but also during, you know, your career when times are tough and you get demotivated. It's knowing what's on the other end. It's knowing, how am I making a difference, whether it's to society, to yourself, to your family, and being wedded to that idea from a deeper level, a sense of purpose.
I think something that's changed an awful lot in certainly the last couple of generations. Well, for one thing, we're living a lot longer, which is why we're seeing a big rise in what people are calling grey divorce rates. So people getting the kind of 50s, 60s and going, do you know what? Could be living another 40 years and be married to this miserable so-and-so. Let's get a divorce. But also we're seeing people changing careers numerous times during the course of their lifetime. And studies showing time and time again, they're actually, you know, you can be incredibly happy if you do change career in your 30s and 40s. But that can be quite a difficult thing for old generations to get their head around. For, you know, for someone in their teens or early 20s to go, I might be thinking about being an accountant now, but that might not be what I'm doing in 20 years, or I don't really know what I'm going to do. So when it comes to teens coming to you, do most of them have a plan in mind and need your help getting there? Or can it be a case of sometimes starting from scratch and trying to narrow down what can feel like a hugely overwhelming number of choices, Audrey?
To be honest with you, I'd say it's about 60-40. 60% of the students that I meet, whether they're in university or pre-university, they're not wedded to a career choice. They know what they want in life. They know they want to make money, not necessarily a lot, but enough to live and be happy. They understand their lifestyle now and sort of key figures and facts of what they would like in the future. But how they're going to get there, they're not sure. And that's what causes the anxiety. That's what causes the stress, because I know what I want, but I don't know how to get there. Or I know what I want, but I can't vocalize it enough to start the path on figuring out how to get there. And it's really lovely because, you know, we really sit down and I look deeper at, well, you think you know what you want, and that's great, but why is that important to you? And when they start to understand why it's important, then the choices open up in terms of the career choices, right? So you might think, oh, if I want to help people and people have, and there's COVID, it's diseases, so I must get into medicine and I must find cures. And yes, that's true, but there are other ways that you can also have a deep impact in people's lives. Where do you think would be the best choice to put your energies? And the other side of it is, if you know you're not good in math and sciences, why are you hurting yourself focusing on the areas that are not your strength?
Why torture yourself for years?
You can find success within your strengths. Mm-hmm. You just have to find the career paths that allow you to spread your wings and thrive. And that's also one of the reasons why you have adults changing their careers later in life.
Exactly. So when you start to feel like you're not living by your values and it's making you really deeply unhappy. Audrey Shane has been in touch saying, every time I ask my son, age 14, what he wants to do in life, he says, I don't know. He doesn't even attempt to have a think about the future. Are some teenagers just that way? I can see you grinning on Microsoft Teams. This perhaps is not an unfamiliar kind of situation.
No, it's not. And oftentimes, the teens do have an idea. They just don't know they have an idea, or they're afraid to say what's truly on their mind. So sometimes it's just easier to say, I don't know, and let it go and hope that your parents will drop the issue. But what I advise parents when I coach them, because I do coach a lot of parents on communicating with their teens and improving that relationship, especially before they go to uni, is the first thing is to accept that it's complicated, right? It's not an easy question to answer, because you don't know where your teen is coming from. So the second thing on top of accepting it's complicated is communication, being very open and approaching the whole thing with a very inquisitive and open mindset. So it's a lot of it comes down to the questioning, right? It's about using open-ended questions that get them to think. So if your teen says, I don't know, well, okay, well, have you thought about anything? You know, or what type of things have you thought about? You know, you're really good in, or you seem to be have strengths in X, Y, and Z. Would you like to investigate or, you know, brainstorm some ideas together? The most important about the open mindset is not to be confrontational, mm-hmm. right? Because parents, we naturally want to help our teens. And when they put a roadblock up and we want to help, the first thing we do is get annoyed. I'm trying to help you. Why aren't you listening?
And strangely, thinking back to my teenage years, I don't think I'd respond very well to that. I'd be like, back off, mum. Or probably, I would say, or dad. It's definitely my mum. And you find yourself withdrawing and not wanting to have that conversation.
You tune them out, or you find other ways to not have to deal with it. So it's about persistence, but persistence in a very open and friendly format. And a persistence that's very encouraging. You know, expressing where you recognize their strengths or good habits or interest areas, and asking them to explore with you and give you their insights. But the most important thing is for you not to give them your insights, right? So it's not about you saying, well, you seem to be good in sports. Have you thought about becoming an athlete? Mm-hmm. Well, no, they might be good in sports, but want to be a sports medicine doctor, or might want to be in sports management. Mm-hmm. Right? So,
I thought it was going to get easier once my kids got older. It sounds like bigger kids are bigger problems.
They're different problems.
Different, okay. A great question from Anya, saying, what kind of assessments do you do during career coaching, and are the parents around when the kids are doing their sessions? Can you kind of break it down and demystify what would happen during a career coaching session? Because I think that's a really good point, because in some ways, if I was thinking about it, I'm like, okay, we're paying for coaching, and I want my child to get something out of this. I want to respect their privacy, but I also want to know everything. So how do you kind of toe that line?
So the first thing I do is I have an agreement between my client and their parents. And the agreement is normally parents are not involved in the coaching sessions unless it's discussed beforehand, because this is a safe space for them to be able to explore. And some of the things they say, they're not sure that parents are going to be happy with the outcome. So they're trying to explore how to say it and how to bring it. So we normally will discuss and agree on either touch points in the coaching. So maybe at the, right at the beginning, halfway through, and then at the end, where the teen has a chance to express themselves at the end, feeling more confident. And then in the middle, where we start to some of the tricky points are and demystify both sides' focus or ideas on it to maybe get through an issue or to break a barrier. When it comes to, some parents prefer to get a report at the end, and I provide reports for those parents on, you know, exactly what's happened. And I go through it with the teenager first, because it is about their privacy and it's about their ability to not have me step in the way of developing a communication with their parent, mm-hmm. right? I'm here to support that, not hinder that. I don't want to be the gatekeeper.
No, and I think it's actually really valuable actually to have someone who's outside of the family and outside of school that can be asking the questions that, with the best will in the world, might come out of a parent's mouth but not lead to the most productive conversations.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon to you if you have just tuned in. We're talking teens this afternoon in conversation with Audrey Hemetner, the CEO of the Bedrock Programme. She helps teens and young adults determine what they want to do in life, and that could be further education, it could be getting into the workplace, it could just be working out their values and leading a life that makes them happy. She does workshops and one-to-one career coaching sessions as well. Joining us now, we have 14-year-old Aya. Aya wants to be a journalist, and she has a few questions for Audrey. Aya, so nice to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. You're at school now. What are you enjoying studying?
I really like the English language and the subjects you do in English in general. And I like the subjects, the French subject that we do. I also enjoy sports.
And I'm really pleased you've come on to talk to Audrey this afternoon, because what she offers, I think, is really interesting. But it sounds a bit mysterious, I think, to some people. You know, what is coaching for teens? So perhaps you could be asking Audrey some questions now about how to get to, you know, the way you want to be in life, career-wise and otherwise. Audrey, what kind of questions would you normally start with? I know I was only 14, you perhaps work with slightly older children sometimes, but where do you start?
Sure. Hi, Aya. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I wanted to start off by sort of asking, you want to get into journalism. Why?
I just think it's very interesting, and that I like to spread news. For some reason, I don't know. I feel like it's a fun thing to do.
Okay, and when you said you like to spread news, yes?
I like to talk and inform people about things.
And what does it mean to you when you talk and inform people about things?
I just feel like I've accomplished something. Like I've how do I say this? Like I've made some. I've added an information to someone.
So you're adding information to someone when you're able to give them information and news and talk to them.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that correct? And you feel accomplished doing that?
Exactly.
And what does it feel like for you when you feel that sense of accomplishment?
I feel like I'm really proud, and I'm happy to let people know what's happening. And I just like doing that. I just feel happy about it.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last bit. You felt what?
Excuse me? I said it makes me happy.
Happy and proud.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. I think that it goes deeper than just being interesting, right? It actually speaks to, I hear you saying, it speaks to a deeper sense of pride. And happiness. And is that a pride or a sense of feeling proud in terms of what you're offering other people, or in terms of how people are looking at you?
In terms of what I'm offering to the people, because it's I don't really mind what people think of me. I just think I bring something new to people.
And is that important to you, that you're bringing something to people?
I like helping people, so it kind of, for me, it gives, it's like the same thing.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I think helping others, offering something to them, helps you feel accomplished, helps you feel proud, and that in turn turns around and makes you feel happy. That's what I've heard you say so far. Am I correct?
Exactly. Yes.
And you feel that you can get this from journalism?
Yes. I feel like I can do that.
That's wonderful.
And if I could just jump in as a journalist, Aya. And for me, that's exactly what it's all about. And I've worked in book publishing, in magazines, and now, of course, on the radio as well as online. And that's exactly what I keep on coming back to, is sharing that information, feeling like you're adding value, starting conversations, and being that kind of conduit. And it feels great in some ways. And sometimes it might be telling, you know, someone about something that's open that could be useful to them, or a service that could improve their lives, or introducing, like we do on the show, introducing people to experts. And that, as long as you can always feel like you're doing that in a way that is honest, and something I always come back to is, would my best friend find this useful? That's always been my kind of barometer, especially when I'm talking about things to do with parenting. You know, that would it pass the Rachel test? And what I can hear you smiling when you're talking about, you know, what you love. And Audrey, I think that's got to be such a positive sign that this is the right thing, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Actually, I was going to ask Aya, what type of journalism are you interested in?
I like a journalist that's on the spot. For example, if there's if there's an event going on, I like to be I want to be there and just talk about it.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
Meet, like, for example, people and talk about them on a show or something.
Audrey, can I ask you, you know, there are some roles that, you know, the robots are coming, that could well be automated, or, you know, the face of those industries really, really changing. Mm-hmm. Journalists, I'm happy to say, Aya, we're pretty much protected from the robots, which is great. But, you know, if you do have a teen or young adult coming to you and they're wanting to go into an industry that you feel like could be threatened in the future through technology or through, you know, changing industries, what kind of impact, does that have, and what kind of feedback can you give?
So one of the main things, or one of the main tenets that I personally believe in outside of coaching and outside of parenting, is options and choices. And so my coaching and the coaches that work in the Bedrock program, that's what we focus on, is options and choices. So if we have a client who's coming in with a career choice that we know, or we can assume, looks like it's going to be redundant, or any part of it will be redundant because of technology, then we start looking at brainstorming options and choices. Because there's never just one career choice that fits the bill in terms of hitting the fundamentals for any individual. It's just that they don't necessarily know all the options and choices. So by starting with the why and the foundation, you can then say, oh, but could you achieve those same feelings and emotions if you also did this? Mm-hmm. Or what other career choices do you think could also create that type of, whether it's change or you know, impact to society? And we go deep into that sort of analysis and understanding from their perspective.
I think that's really interesting, because it's giving direction, but you're not necessarily just being blinkered to one specific job title or industry. So for journalism, for example, it could be working in communications, it could be PR, it could be, you know, working for a non-profit in their communications department. There's all sorts of different things you can do, and of course all sorts of different mediums as well. I really hope that's been useful, and wishing you all the very best with your career moving forward. It sounds like you've been asking yourself the right questions, and I think you'll be fantastic. Have a good
Absolutely.
One. Keep in touch. We are family.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Delighted to be joined by Coach Audrey Mattner from the Bedrock Programme. She works with teens and young people, helping them determine what to do in life, asking them the questions that perhaps we as parents want to ask, but we know it might not necessarily result in a productive conversation. Audrey, a really interesting message here, no name on this one, saying, my daughter is very creative and talented and would like to become an artist. She wants to go to art school, but I also think she needs to get a business degree. Then she can set up an art company, be smart about selling her pieces. She doesn't think so. What are your thoughts? I just don't want her to be broke when she's all grown up. Otherwise, I'll be paying her rent. It's a tricky one, isn't it? You know, wanting to be encouraging, but also perhaps wanting to be realistic. How can you strike that right balance?
Well, I think that this mother is right to listen to what her daughter wants and to understand that she wants to go down the creative route. I think that that's the first step, because by her daughter knowing that she's listening to her, it opens the door for the daughter to listen to some of the mum's fears. And that's valid. Nobody wants to be a starving artist. I think those days are long gone. But it is important for her daughter to focus on the art and being creative. So what I would suggest to the mother is, approach the finance side of things, because what I hear her saying is not that she doesn't want her daughter to be in art, she just doesn't want her daughter to be poor. So approach her daughter from a concept of, okay, dear, if you were to go down the pure art route like you see it, tell me how you would support the lifestyle that you want. So let her start to come up with the ideas on how she's not going to be poor. And then, of course, if you want her to understand money more than she does now, you sort of maybe nudge her towards taking some budgeting classes or talking to her about financial and fiscal responsibility. So she might show a little bit of an interest in learning more about how she can support herself as well as pursue what she wants.
I think that's really valid. My brother's a musician, and for a long time it was like, oh, Mike's going to be a drummer and make no money. And, you know, I think for my parents to really understand his drive and understand how to support him, they realised that he was such a hard worker. He wasn't shirking at academics so he could just, you know, just perform in, you know, nightclubs. He dedicated himself morning, noon and night to practice. He got a scholarship to go to university in America, and he is now, I'm proud to say, a rock star. Not a very busy one right now because of COVID, but it does take a certain type of parent to be able to encourage something in the arts, really. So be there, because you might be paying her rent for a little bit, but I'm sure when she's, you know, auctioning pieces off for millions, she'll remember her parents. Lastly, Audrey, you have a message for pushy parents. How do you sum that up? Because I fear I might be one in the future.
Look, it's not an easy thing. Parents are here. We bring children into the world and we want to see them succeed. And some parents are a bit more pushy about it than others. And a lot of parents who are pushy don't realize they're being pushy. They honestly are doing it out of the goodness of their heart, that they think they're offering guidance and support. Oftentimes the children rebel and it doesn't look pretty. So I would say to a parent, if you're worried about whether or not you're being pushy or you're trying to figure out why your teen is not reacting, do a bit of self-reflection. The first thing you need to find out from yourself is, why are you pushing so hard? Right? It's not about you. I mean, it is about you, because as a parent, we care about how our child reflects on us to the rest of the world, right? Are they going to an Ivy League school because you always wanted to, you never did, or because you did and it's expected? And how is that going to affect, or how is that affecting your child, right? Your teen is still your child. And money is basic. Every parent wants their child not to be the poor beggar on the street. That's fine. But it's got to be more than money, right? Do you want them to have money and be miserable and be living a life that they're not proud of or ashamed of? Or would you like the money and a happy, healthy human being that is proud of their accomplishments and can come to you with that gratitude that you're looking for? Mm-hmm. And if it's the latter that you want, then you need to listen more.
Wise
words.
It's
not about us.
Okay, fine. I'm listening to you. Audrey Jimena, thank you so, so much. Can I just say, I can see you in Microsoft. You're wearing a spectacular top with what looks like a basset hound on. It's brilliant. Have a wonderful, wonderful afternoon ahead. For anyone, and we have had numerous messages saying how to get in touch, it's Audrey. She's the CEO of the Bedrock Programme.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking about play this afternoon, its importance in our family lives, not just for education, but also the relationships too. And joined this afternoon by Lily Allen Talbot. She is from the Lego Group. She joined there back in 2013, lives in Denmark with her husband, who's also a Lego designer. And she recently led the design conceptualization for Lego Art. And I think it's fair to say, you probably have my dream job, and probably what might be a dream job for many big kids and small kids alike. But can you explain a little bit about what it actually involves, Lily? And thank you, by the way. I know it's Sunday, so it's your weekend in Denmark. So I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Helen. I'm really excited to be here talking about one of my absolute favorite things, which is play and just how wonderful and important and joyful play is. So to answer your question a little bit about what it's like to be a Lego designer, it's a lot of fun. It's also a lot of work. We come up with new ideas all the time, talk to families, talk to kids, find out what's interesting to them, what's important to them, and we make an idea, we take it to them, they tell us they don't like it, and then we go back, we work on that idea again, we do it over and over, and we just keep working on it until it's just right, until we find the magic that makes it really special and exciting to play with. So it's a long process behind making a Lego set, but it's such an exciting and rewarding process when we see families and kids enjoying the work that we've done.
Strange question, but in terms of kind of regional tastes and buying and play patterns, you're from the States, you're living in Denmark,
yes.
We're here in Dubai. Do you notice certain patterns when it comes to certain nationalities or demographics resonating with certain sets or themes?
I think I'm more impressed by how much similarity there is. Like, you're right, there's such a wonderful diversity globally, but we see so much similarity in how people like to play, how we express our creativity, how we communicate and work through our emotions through play. And it's really, you might expect to see a lot of differences because of the amazing diversity that we have in the world. But those commonalities behind the player was just really exciting to see, I think.
Oh, we were talking earlier today about anxiety in children and how play can help. And I wondered if you've seen any evidence of that.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Play is a wonderful way for people, for kids and for people to really just let off some steam now and then, right? Like you can learn a lot through play, you can explore the world through play, but it's also a chance to be silly. And when we look at how many times in our life we actually get to be silly, or kids have a chance to be silly, those moments are getting smaller and smaller. So the more opportunity that you can have to just kind of shake your shoulders and relax and hang out with your friends and laugh, the more it's gonna help with tempering that. I mean, play has helped even my anxiety as an adult, relaxing into a video game now and then, or playing a board game with friends. Like, definitely play can help with easing those symptoms.
And what then about the relationship? As I said, it's not just about, you know, learning about, you know, shapes and counting, and, you know, if you build fast it might not work, and that kind of, you know, trying and failing. But playing with, you know, your child is so, so important for your relationship. Do you know much about the kind of the mechanics and science behind even what happens in our bodies, you know, when we play with our kids, and what it can do for strengthening those bonds?
I don't think I can speak to the science as well. I know that there have been some fantastic studies around this, but we see from the just from the relationship side how important it is for kids and their parents or guardians to play. And kids just want to play so badly with their parents and their families and their guardians. They want to share that bond and share that moment with them. So we're definitely going to see opportunities to increase your communication, or increase moments of that bonding and working through problems together through play. Any of that, play is just an opportunity to spend more time together in that way. And like I said before, a bit of that silliness now and then. It's good for kids to see us bring that as well.
And I think, you know, what's great about, you know, as you mentioned, board games there, or, you know, card games or Lego in this situation, there are some things, and they're quite rare, to be honest, that can be equally enjoyed with children and adults. And many people are hugely passionate about the brick. A number of messages. Asha saying, the fun of Lego is making the original, then rebuilding and combining it to make things of your own imagination. The options are limitless. We love it in our house. I've heard of people gluing sets together. No fun at all. Gluing sets together? Do people do this?
There are some collectors who maybe do that, or you'll see when a model gets really large, when a Lego model gets really large, like for display purposes, a lot of artists who use Lego as a medium and they transport it between museums, for example, then they might glue it together. So it also, if you're at Legoland and you'll see those big statues that are built, that's for safety and stability that we build it together. But I think on the daily, definitely love to see people change and grow, and really excited to hear that anecdote as well, that they're changing and building and making their own things from their own imaginations. That is so exciting, and that's exactly what we hope to see with Lego bricks.
A question from Emma here saying, our daughter is 5 in a couple of weeks. She built her first Lego set yesterday by herself with a little bit of guidance from me. It was a Lego Friends set that said age 4+ on the box. She's never been that into building, preferring role play, so I'm really pleased that she enjoyed it so much. I wanted to get her a few more sets for her birthday, but I'm wondering what age sets to get. I know the ones she loved, like Cinderella Rapunzel, say 6 on the box. It's the aged recommendation determined by the complexity of the build, the size or number of pieces, or difficulty. I don't want to get her anything too tricky and put her off. Really good question, I think, in terms of appropriateness, I guess. What would you say to Emma and her 5-year-old?
It's a fantastic question. We definitely, the age recommendation is there based on all of the things you just mentioned. So complexity, the size, we're thinking about the patience of a 4 or 5-year-old when they're building through that. Mm-hmm. How long are they going to want to sit and do the building process before they jump into the role play? So definitely those age markings are a recommendation. Say if she built that set mostly by herself, from the sounds of it, she would probably be okay with a 6+, but just stay on hand to help her out. There might be one or two sections where a brick is a little harder to put together, or maybe there's a little bit of a fiddly bit. But I think anywhere between the 4 and 6, she'll probably be okay if you're there next to her.
Brilliant.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Lily Ann Talbot joining us direct from Denmark, where she works for Lego as a designer. Conceptualising ideas, Lego art was a recent project. She's a product owner in the Creative Play Lab, and her husband is also a Lego designer. What's behind you? I can see you on Microsoft Teams, Lily. What's your Lego display? Can you explain?
So this is a West Talbot original. That's my husband. As mentioned, he also works at Lego as a designer. We have quite a fondness for castles and dragons. I'm in my living room right now, so I've got dragon artwork on the wall, and this is a massive Lego castle that he designed from his imagination in our personal collection at home. So
very cool.
Quite a few castles around this house.
I love it, living the Lego house. Lots of people getting in touch, sharing their enthusiasm, and also some questions about Lego as well, Lily. Vivek, I love this question, saying, sorting Lego for ease of use. Is it best to sort by colour or type of brick? My kids' collection is out of control, and it's our Ramadan project. What, as an expert, do you recommend?
Oh my goodness, I think this debate could go for quite a while. Some people like to sort by color. Some people like to sort by shape. We have our personal collection sorted by shape in a lot of small individual bins, which are actually just left over from takeout food.
Okay,
so we
good to know.
Rinse out the plastic containers, and we've got lots of little ones, and we sort them according to the shape. If you don't have much space, it's better to have them by shape with all the colors mixed in, because it's going to be a lot harder to find that particular brick you're looking for. than it will be to find the color. Mm-hmm. So it won't matter so much if you've got black and green and yellow all in one place, as long as the pieces are the same. But a lot of it's personal preference.
Okay, you've inspired me, Vivek. That's my evening plans, tragically sorted out. We've got a big old box with them all chucked in, and then which do need to be addressed. And then we've got a people box, which looks a bit sinister, especially when it's just heads pulled off. And then we've got a nature box, an eye box. So yeah, okay, Vivek, I'm joining you on this campaign. And Lisa's been in touch saying, thoughts on adult workshops using Lego for team building, and how can that work for content? What sets would you recommend for corporates? Great question.
That's such a fantastic question. So we have a set called Serious Play, and I'll have to follow up and make sure that it's still on our website. I believe it is. But if it's not, definitely check out our Lego Classic line. It's very classic brick shapes and a lot of really fantastic and fun colors. So a lot of just raw material to work with there to make it into whatever you need. And there's a website, which I'd have to hunt down the name, but if you look up like six Lego bricks, it comes up with a variety of ideas of what you can do with just six Lego bricks or six Duplo bricks to do different activities and exactly that sort of team building activity.
Love it. Bit of creativity. I want to come back to parents playing. And I think this is a really common problem, is that, you know, we get caught up in our busy lives of, you know, doing boring adult things, and we kind of forget how to play. So what would you say to any parents that might feel a bit silly or self-conscious, or if we have forgotten how to do it, where to start, Lily?
Oh, that's such a fantastic question. If we think about playing with kids, they are very excited to do it with us, but they often don't help with making it fun, right? Like, they like to make up their own rules along the way, and they don't always tell us about the rules when they're coming up with them. So it's really a good start to pick something that you're on equal ground with your kid on, right? So pick a story world that you both know really, really well. Pick characters that you both know really well. Put yourself in a play situation where you're going to be on the same team, for example, where you're going on a mission together and you're not in a battle or a competition scenario, because that is immediately going to foster this communication and this collaboration in the play that's just really fun and authentic to get into. And don't be afraid of that silliness a little bit. Like we talked about a bit before, it's okay to give into that. It can feel a bit embarrassing. It can feel a bit like we're beyond this, but you're also a play expert. I think this is the thing that adults forget, is that we already know how to play because we've been kids. We have maybe just forgotten that a little bit. We've stepped away from it. So find a comfortable entry point with that world or that story or those characters that you know. Agree on the rules beforehand so the kids can't change them on you in the middle of the game. And then eventually I think you'll get to the point where where it's okay for that silliness to come in and the embarrassment maybe goes away a little bit more.
My kids only have one rule when we're playing, and it's no phones. So they put my phone under a cushion on the sofa. And I think they're right, to be honest, the wisdom of children. So being present in play, because I can't play with them for hours a day as much as I would like to. So when I can, it's all in. Lily, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now? Are we able to have a sneak kind of peek at, can you tell us what could be coming to our shelves? It was Lego art for you recently. What's next?
Oh my gracious, there's so many fantastic things coming out, and I'm afraid I can't speak too much about them, but I'm just very excited to go in and work on this every day, and I'm really, really happy to see all of the fantastic creations that people have made with their Lego bricks, so definitely keep sharing them.
Thank you for all of your inspirations on play this afternoon, and I'm going to let you get back to your Sunday, and I'm going to go home and sort some bricks out. Lillian Talbot there, speaking to us from Denmark, where she works with Lego as product owner in the Creative Play Lab. So go forth, people, build, destroy, play and enjoy. We are families.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking education this hour and speaking now to David Cook, the headmaster of Repton School Dubai. He's also the CEO of the Repton Family of Schools here in the UAE. And last week, they held a virtual media roundtable hosted by the Repton Family of Schools. And we're really kind of getting under the skin of that education system. We know what has been happening at the highest levels and what do we need to know as parents? Having been through a year of COVID, and frankly, things still unfolding. So David joining us now to look back at some of the key findings and some of the things we need to know in terms of COVID, safety and schools as well. Now, David, since last time we spoke, there's been some huge changes when it comes to, well, routine, which is amazing, but also in terms of healthcare and, you know, vaccinations. Happy to say I am vaccinated. My parents in the UK are now vaccinated. We've seen, you know, hitting the 10 million mark here in the UAE. But can I ask you, what effect do you think that the vaccination numbers have had on, you know, parents' confidence sending kids into school even? Have you seen much of a difference since the vaccinations came in from people switching from distance learning to in class?
Thanks, Helen. I think the short answer to that is probably yes, as the vaccination program has rolled out. I think that does add to one's confidence, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. That we're very lucky here in the UAE that it's one of the highest levels of vaccination rates in the world. I'm from the UK, equally very high vaccination rates there. That's bound to have an impact on families, on parents, as they decide whether they can send their children to school. We've been lucky, the Repton Family of Schools, we've averaged just over 80% attendance in school since August. And we're seeing a slight uptick as that happens. As a school, we've taken the view that by the 1st of September, no later than the 1st of September, we want every member of staff to be fully vaccinated. But the KHJ, and your listeners will know, Helen, that the KHJ and the Ministry of Education are trying to encourage as many of us to get vaccinated right across the Emirates to help each other, to protect each other. Mm-hmm. So we have seen a gradual return. Those numbers have gone up slightly. Inevitably, there are a small minority of children who have to stay at home, usually because they're shielding vulnerable family members. But I think, yes, vaccination has definitely helped.
And it's such a personal decision. There's certainly no right or wrong, but I do think there is a vote of confidence when, yeah, as you say, getting to 100% vaccinations across staff, you know, it's a real milestone for so many schools and so many industries as well, you know, whether that is on an airplane or in a classroom or in a restaurant. I know, I don't want to say it, but the kind of the hot topic over the weekend for me and friends that I'm speaking to seems to be, what are your summer plans? What are you going to be doing? Have you booked anything? And I feel like this is what everybody's talking about right now. I've got my mum in the UK who's giving me the puppy dog eyes being like, are you going to come back and see us? And me having to say, we don't know. You know, are you speaking to parents about family plans in the summer? You know, and if so, what are some of the paperwork or guidelines that you'll need to have in place?
Another great question. And we're all wrestling with that, aren't we? I think I want to say in the first place, if we take us back to the start of the pandemic, term was brought forward in term three last March. So spring break was effectively was lost in preparation for remote learning. And then many, many people didn't travel last summer. So here we are now 13 or 14 months into the pandemic and really positive news about vaccination rates. So I guess the overwhelming desire will be for many, many families to travel. International schools, certainly UK curriculum schools, will recruit over 80% of their staff directly from the UK. And therefore, many of those teachers, many families haven't returned to the UK. So I think this summer, in many ways, represents the best opportunity, doesn't it, to go back. But each family will have different circumstances. We're all waiting to hear what countries across the world say about quarantining. And we want to do so which is safe. But a little bit of reassurance. We spotted a little bit of travel over spring break, actually, Helen. Some of our families did travel. Some of our staff traveled. The Dubai Health Authority asks all staff and all adults to fill in the health declaration form. And that's a really useful way of schools and others monitoring travel patterns over the break. So I guess the health authorities will ask for something similar this summer.
I think a lot of it comes down to timing. And I know some families did travel last year and were just trying to make sure that they were back in the UAE in time to, you know, be tested and have a quarantine period. And as I said, we don't know what that situation is going to be in terms of, you know, red, amber, or hopefully green. And, you know, teachers, as you say, it's a really interesting time in terms of recruitment. But when we think back to you know, holidays over the course of the last year as well. You know, a lot of teachers having to prepare distance learning, online learning tools, and work in a completely different way. And, you know, having been through distance learning a year ago and then again just before spring break because of a case in my daughter's class, it was night and day. It really, really was. Teachers were so on top of it. The, you know, the tools and the templates were in place. It felt like a much more easy transition. So huge kudos to the teachers and the educators over the course of the last, as you say, 12 to 14 months, because there's been a lot of pressure and a lot of work on their shoulders as well. You know, what kind of steps do you feel like schools and principals can be taking to ease the burden on teachers and other school staff as we do find ourselves a year into the pandemic?
If I may, I want to say to your listeners as well, it's not only teachers who've done an extraordinary job, it's also parents, because parents at very short notice, as I said on the media roundtable, have found themselves as actually classroom assistants on the kitchen table. They're actually supporting their children's learning whilst getting feedback, usually through a device, through an iPad or through a PC, directly communicating with teachers. Teachers now have got two audiences. They've got a live audience in front of them of about 80% of pupils, but about 20% of those pupils are at home, probably on a bedroom table or on the dining room table. And therefore, teachers, we want to try and avoid them teaching twice and duplication because there aren't enough hours in the day. So the schools are doing all they can to say, what is it we can do to help teachers to reduce anything that's unnecessary so they can really focus on the quality of their teaching and learning to these two audiences? A good example of that, and every organisation will have a different views on this, we found our teachers were starting very early and then working very late at night. So we introduced a no email policy across the schools after a certain period of time, just to say to colleagues, we've got to allow staff to have a bit of downtime. Otherwise, they're teaching to these two audiences, and if we're not careful, they might get it right for 2 or 3 weeks. And this has gone on now for a year. We've got to make it sustainable.
I love this. Can we make this a nationwide policy of no emails after, oh, I don't know, 5 o'clock? That would be dreamy. I'm just putting it out there just for when voting starts for Helen Farmer as Queen of the World. You can be my running mate, David. I think that's a brilliant, brilliant idea, because we know what we feared at the beginning, and whether that's teachers or people across different industries, was, you know, working from home wasn't going to be productive. And what we saw instead was insane productivity and an ability for people to actually switch off, because those lines were just so, so blurred. And we've seen burnout. We've seen people being fearful of losing their jobs and really just unbelievably stressed. So, you know, if anything, please let's see if we can move away from that. From, you know, and that does come from higher up. It really does. And to, I hope you've been, you know, walking the walk, not just talking the talk, and behaving yourself on your screen time, and that's been under control, David. Mr. Cook?
It's a good lesson to us all, isn't it? But at what stage do we stop being effective? We can keep going. And as you say, there's a lot of anxiety and there's been a lot of fear, both the fear of health, and then obviously the health crisis has become, for many people, an economic or financial crisis. And therefore, there is the fear of losing job and doing the right thing and wanting to do the right thing, but it's got to be sustainable. So I try and practice what I preach. I do try and take Fridays off, and I do try and stop by about 6 p.m. Otherwise, I find I'm just not effective the next day.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking education this afternoon, I've been chatting with David Cook. He's the Chief Executive Officer at Repton Schools and the Headmaster at Repton Dubai. He says parents are more involved in their children's schooling than ever before, and that's probably not going to change anytime soon.
I think the days of parents really only checking in once or twice a year, but effectively leaving their children over to the school for most of the time, is gone, actually. I think if there has been a silver lining. Technology has brought parents and schools closer together, so that parents have got a direct involvement. I can see exactly what's going on with their children's learning. And schools right across Dubai, right across the UAE, have done a brilliant job in looking for different ways to engage with parents and say, okay, what might be a new normal? I'd be very surprised, for instance, if after the pandemic, is there going to be a post-pandemic world where online parent webinars, online parent evenings, and just opportunities to engage So if there is an issue, rather than expect a parent and summon a parent to come to the school, and that's often hugely inconvenient, it might cost half a day. Let's set up a Zoom call and let's talk this through, and then we can see each other and have a conversation. So I do think lines of communication is definitely improved, and I don't think we'll want to go. And why should parents want to go back to the old days?
Now, we can't have a discussion about current state of education in the future without talking money. Because this was the, I don't want to say hoo-ha, but it was certainly setting WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups ablaze a year ago when it was going to distance learning. Some schools and groups were offering discounts, others weren't. Sometimes it was going to be means tested. People needed to prove that they were taking a salary cut or had lost their job. And I just wondered, what are you hearing from parents now? Obviously, situation still continuing in terms of salary reductions and job losses, tragically. So are parents asking for more relief as that job situation does see little improvement?
I'm not sure they're asking for more relief, but I am aware that this is, as I said, the health crisis for many, many families became a financial challenge, no question. All schools right across the UAE have tried to be as generous as they possibly can be, given their particular model. Repton set up a family fund. We've helped between 300 and 400 direct families. We also decided to reduce fees in term three, a modest reduction, but we wanted to make some attempt because we knew that, well, we just knew from dozens and dozens of our parents the challenges that they had faced. And the other thing that's interesting is both the regulators and schools themselves decided again that actually a fee freeze was appropriate for most schools. Now, I've got enormous respect for some schools and that doesn't work for their model. We've been incredibly lucky here with the Repton Family Schools that we've actually frozen fees now for 3 years before the pandemic. We want to make sure that this is affordable. Parents want both sides, of course, as well. They want great teachers. One of those issues is, in a global market, is making sure we recruit the best teachers, math specialists or chemistry specialists and physics specialists. There is a market for those positions. They're highly sought after. The number of international schools around the world is growing. There's some things that schools can do, and they have tried as much as possible to absorb costs, but there is still a requirement to say there is a certain level which we cannot go below.
In light of exams being cancelled, not just here but internationally as well, I'd like you to get your crystal ball out, please, Mr. David Cook, and really have a think about the future of education, and do you believe exams have a space there?
I do think there'll be some form of terminal exam or terminal assessment. The world is still competitive. World-class universities or very high-ranking universities, I mean, that's where secondary schools like ours are heading afterwards, are still based on merit. But isn't it interesting that the big debate now is not just about ability, it's also about attitude and aptitude. And I guess if the pandemic's taught us anything, it's those, you alluded to it, deliberate positiveness is really, really important. So someone's attitude is as important, because we're sending youngsters off to university for 3 years. It isn't just whether they get a grade A or a grade 9. It's actually, can I cope with this tough lifestyle? What's my attitude like? Not just what I measured. I do think going forward it will be a blended learning. And what I mean by that, there'll be a combination of in-school or in-university plus learning at home. So I think new models of learning. Technology has accelerated. Technology was already emerging in education and in all of life, but technology, it's accelerated, hasn't it? We've all become experts at MS Teams or Zoom or Seesaw or Showbeyond apps, and some of those things have been really beneficial. The creativity, for instance, has been brilliant. There are dangers, of course, but overall, so the world is more reliant on technology and is going to try and get the best fit creativity from technology. There will always be a place for end of year or end of assessment exams, but maybe could we do those differently? Could they be online? Could they be more multi-choice? It opens up, in many ways, more opportunities.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.